What do you think happens when we inject vaccines that contain animal DNA, animal genetic matter, and animal cells and other animal chemicals? Well, we know that vaccines contain substrates from all these animals that I put up here. This is also not controversial at all. For instance, this Cocker Spaniel is really cute, and you might want to have a Cocker Spaniel as a pet, but you should also know that tumorigenic Cocker Spaniel kidney cells are used to propagate vaccines, and that some of those cells do end up in the vaccine media, but we're told not to worry about it because they're only slightly tumorigenic. And that's the flu vaccines. We know that there is human material, fetal material in vaccines. They're also used, lung fibroblasts are used to propagate. Now think about it, if you need to propagate vats and vats of vaccine in order to make it for the entire world, you need to have cells that divide really rapidly so that you can grow viruses on or that you can have bacteria growing on. So that's why we need these cells in order to make the vaccines. Okay, they don't just make themselves. So this chick is also really cute, but it's not really cute necessarily when it's injected into you, and we know that it's a very common substrate for vaccine production. This one here I find rather disturbing. That is a caterpillar, and that is used for the Cervarix human papillomavirus vaccine, is used propagated through genetic engineering with that caterpillar cell. And these monkeys, again, this has been part and parcel of vaccine production since the earliest times, because these monkey cells, they divide really rapidly and they grow viruses. The polio vaccines are made on them. We still have vaccines made on them today. There have been lots of problems with these monkey kidney cells. Some of them have been worked out, but we don't, you know, if you don't know what can grow inside of an animal cell, you can't necessarily test for it. And even if you look on the vaccine package inserts, you'll see Vero cells listed, and that comes from monkey, and that's a monkey kidney cell. We know that there's cow blood, cow serum, albumin in vaccines, and that they also boil the hides for the gelatin that's in the vaccines as well. These little piggies here, their stomachs are used to get clumps of cells to break apart so that you can plate them out in a petri dish and grow vaccine on it. This was a problem. Just a few years ago, we heard about the rotavirus vaccine growing a porcine circovirus, but we were told not to worry about it because people that eat pork end up with it. So apparently it's okay to give that to your babies too. There's actually not been very much research of anything I'm aware of as far as any long-term effects of infants consuming porcine circovirus. So how do these things affect your DNA? Your child's DNA function? Well, we don't know because no one's bothered to look at the issue. But consider this. Children received 10 vaccinations in the 1980s before the age of 5. And today, they get 36 vaccines, beginning often in utero or on the first day of life, like we do in the United States. Human brains and human immune systems have definitely changed for the worse, and vaccines can be playing a part. Epigeneticists and vaccinologists say, well, vaccines can train the immune system through epigenetic reprogramming, and they want us to look on the bright side. They always want to paint a picture of how the immune system is going to be improved because of this. But that's not what we see, and that's not what much of the medical literature states. Even if vaccines can prevent some infections, considering what's in them, there's no way they can improve overall health. And now they want to give vaccines to pregnant women, which in addition to these animal cells and associated genetic material, also have aluminium in them. And you can see here Dr. Paul Offit, and he's the doctor that I mentioned in the beginning, who says that infants can tolerate 100,000 vaccines at once, theoretically, although there's never been any animal model for that. That's his theory. Well, in the context of medical literature, it's astonishing that one of the most well-published vaccine proponents, Paul Offit, and he's a key opinion person who's the go-to soundbite for the American pro-vaccine movement, that he could publish this on his website. He educates doctors worldwide on vaccination. And on his website, from the Children's Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, the Vaccine Education Center, in April of 2013, you could have gone on there and read about your concerns about aluminium in pregnancy, and you could have been totally set at ease by seeing what this website had to say, because this quote was on his website, and it said, "Aluminium is considered to be an essential metal with quantities fluctuating naturally during normal cellular activity. It is found in all tissues and also believed to play an important role in the development of a healthy fetus." Well, I PDF'd that web page in April 2013, and I sent it with a link to one of the world's most knowledgeable aluminium experts, who's usually very diplomatic and polite. And he wrote me back stating something not very flattering about Dr. Paul Offit, which I won't repeat here. But wouldn't you think that a man who considers himself highly educated would have read this following quote that was published in 2011? Dr. Kawahara published a very important article that needs to be read by anybody who has concerns about aluminium. And amongst other things in that article, in the very beginning, he says, "Whilst being environmentally abundant, aluminium is not essential for life. On the contrary, aluminium is a widely recognized neurotoxin that inhibits more than 200 biologically important functions and causes various adverse effects in plants, animals, and humans." He goes into great detail about this. All the other aluminium researchers I know have no time for Dr. Paul Offit's comments. We need to look at vaccines in pregnancy more closely, starting with aluminium, to see what it really does do in the body. Dr. Kawahara's article is very important because it supports, with 176 medical references, the fact that aluminium is a death factor for cells. He reviews the most state-of-the-art techniques that have brought aluminium back to the forefront of Alzheimer's research and tells why and how the old research that said it wasn't related to Alzheimer's is flawed. This picture denotes some of the problems that he has documented and found himself with the action of aluminium in the body. Now remember, the aluminium is a small radius, very highly positively charged element. So it's going to be attracted to negative charges in the body. Because of that, it's able to travel to places where it really should never go. One of those places is into the brain. And we now know that it does cross the blood-brain barrier. It crosses in cells called macrophages, and there are special transport systems that shuttle it through. We also know that aluminium binds to phosphate in DNA and RNA in the nucleus. Remember all that epigenetic stuff? Well, guess what? When that binds to phosphates in the nucleus, it influences many genes and regulates in abnormal ways gene function. We also know that it binds to ATP. That stands for adenosine triphosphate, which you may have heard of as it's the most important energy molecule in your body. And that's what's used to give, you know, for me to move my muscle right now or for you to run up a hill. That's what you need. Well, aluminium binds to that and influences energy metabolism. And we know that people with aluminium excess end up with very low energy. This also here is an enzyme, and that's calcium or magnesium. And you should know that enzymes are dependent upon certain elements. And in order for them to function properly and have the right conformation, they need these elements. Well, because aluminium is such a highly negatively charged particle, it actually has more of an affinity for those enzymes than the normal elements that are supposed to be working with it. So it comes in, pops calcium and magnesium right off, and takes over and essentially inhibits those enzymes. Without enzymes, your metabolism really can't work very well. In addition to making those enzymes useless, the fact that it's now bound onto them keeps it in the body longer. So this makes the half-life of aluminium even longer. Over here, we see this is an example of a protein. And we know that proteins are supposed to, for the most part, be separate, doing their jobs. And when the aluminium comes along, it cross-links them. It essentially works as a tanning agent because it coagulates proteins in this way. And it causes conformational change. And having the right shape in a protein is really important because the shape often determines its function. So those conformational changes can actually inhibit the degradation of those proteins by their particular proteases. So you can't actually even use them the way your body wants to use them. So aluminium is a huge deal when it comes to proper cell function. So if we go back here, let me just remind you that it's important in the development of a healthy fetus, and quantities fluctuate naturally during normal cellular activity. We really have to scrutinize that. The other thing aluminium does is it damages cell membranes. Remember, oh, I'm going to show you another picture in a minute. Sorry, I got ahead of myself. So this is a cell membrane, a representation of it, phospholipids here. The lipids are in the middle and the phosphos are on the outside. And in the presence of iron, some of these lipid membranes can be damaged. And that's why we have our own antioxidant system. But in the presence of aluminium, these pro-oxidant reactions will happen more. So it's called peroxidation. So it's basically like hydrogen peroxide, which actually can be very toxic to cells. So when aluminium comes in with this iron, it will catalyze using certain enzymes and cause problems in that membrane. And remember what I showed you earlier, that the cell membranes and the environment and what's happening in those membranes has everything to do with how genes function and how the cell functions and how cells talk to each other and whether they grow or whether they die or differentiate and turn into different cells, or whether they turn into cancer. Have a look at this schematic of a cell membrane, which is actually more realistic appearing than the one you saw before. And consider that each of your cells has around 100,000 switches, which have what are called receptors and effectors, meaning it has a signal comes in and then it has an action, okay? Now, that opens and closes to various substances on the outside, and it transmits signals to the inside, telling the nucleus what to do. Then consider the fact that after aluminium exposure, the membranes and the myelin, which is very important for nerve function, become stiff and dysfunctional. Dr. Verstraeten wrote two articles that are really important that detailed in his experimental models showing how the membranes changed in the face of aluminium. And Dr. Kawahara listed several pages of the biological processes that are significantly altered during low levels of aluminium. And he talked about three of them with medical references and how they change the lipid and phospholipids in the body, how they change the physical properties of this membrane, and how they change this membrane fluidity. I think of this as like the kind of car wash that you can go through that has the flaps that go down. And so your proteins are needing to move through this like it's fluid. It's almost like it's a matrix that these proteins can pop up and they can come back down and they can migrate. And it's very important that they're able to move around the way they're supposed to and that this area stays functional. So when you toss aluminium into that, everything changes. The signals that are coming through are altered. Now, this slide looks like a handful, but I'm going to explain everything in it to you. I'm going to explain this slide in detail. So this DAMPS stands for damage-associated molecular patterns. And these are basically things that your cells recognize as alarm signals. And in response to that, they secrete chemicals called cytokines, which recruit other cells which come and clean up the mess and deal with it. Okay, and in that process can be very inflammatory. And then the anti-inflammatory side comes down and dampens it down. This is called pathogen-associated molecular patterns, but that's not what I'm going to talk about right now. The aluminium comes in, causes cell damage, secretes all the insides of cells, which alert the immune system, and bring those substances that it came and encountered, including the aluminium and the stuff that leaked out of cells, and brings it to what's called an antigen-presenting cell. That antigen-presenting cell then starts to secrete its own cytokines and will call in T cells. These T cells will then recruit other generations of cells to either inflame, to clean up a mess, because sometimes inflammation is good. It actually helps clean up problems and kill bacteria and dead flesh. And remove that dead flesh. And then you need the anti-inflammatory arm to come along and silence that. But what happens with aluminium is that this pro-inflammatory response, which is a Th17, gets set off. This one here, which is a T follicular helper cell system, gets set off. And this one here, the humoral immunity, which is the side that antibodies are secreted and can be associated with allergies, also gets set off. And this is very well documented and established in molecular biology that this Th2 system is skewed and biased after the exposure to aluminium. And it's actually the basis for why they use it in vaccines. So these infiltrating cells that come in here, these phagocytes here, they will come in and they will have an unlimited diet of aluminium. Now that's different than if you get a cut on your skin that can be dealt with and it's done and over with. These persistent particles continue to stimulate this process and set off an oxidative stress bonfire in the skin, in the system, and causes massive amounts of inflammation. These cells will eat until they die, and then they will release their various substances and continue that process. This is just a better schematic of what happens in the cell. So this is the aluminium adjuvant. That's what it's called, adjuvant, meaning that it helps the vaccine have its inflammatory response. We have cell damage because where that needle goes makes all the difference, and whether there's a needle or not makes all the difference when it comes to aluminium. I'm just going to step aside and just explain this top part for a minute. Because the other thing that we hear on websites like Dr. Paul Offit's is that we shouldn't be worried about aluminium because it's a very abundant metal in the Earth's crust, and we're eating it and drinking it all the time, and it's in our baked goods, and we shouldn't be worried about it. Well, when you eat aluminium, you absorb somewhere between 0.2% and 1.5% of it, okay? When you inject aluminium, you absorb 100% of it. Now, you can inject it in two ways. You can put it directly into a blood vessel, which is how the one study that they used for injection did it, put it right into intravenously. Well, you don't get this happening when you put that into a blood vessel. You don't have that kind of cell damage and all this inflammatory response when you put it into a blood vessel. The trick is to inject it into a muscle, and that's why vaccines are delivered into muscles, because the goal for a vaccine, an injected intramuscular vaccine, is to put this adjuvant in there with the particle of either a virus or bacteria and set off an immune reaction that hopefully your cells will remember when they're encountered with that same microbe in the future. So remember that intramuscular is key to causing the damage that I'm talking about here. Now, drinking it is still not a good idea, but you need a lot more of it to become toxic as long as you have normal kidney function. Okay, so this adjuvant is injected. You get the cell damage, and what happens when you get cell damage is that the cells usually will just break open. Those membranes will open, and their contents will spill out. Well, it turns out that some of the contents inside of cells are designed to be inflammatory. It's almost like an acid in there because you want it to be there if you want it to take in a microbe and dissolve it. But what you don't want to happen is for those cells to then break open and cause more inflammation in the body. And that can happen sometimes, which is why we need all those antioxidants in our diet and in our bodies. But normally, that shouldn't be going on and on and on. But what happens here is that the cell breaks open, ATP comes out, DNA comes out, uric acid comes out, these phagolysosomes break open and spill their contents, all highly inflammatory, okay? So then you're calling in more immune cells and more T helper cells to come in and deal with the problem. They come in and they encounter more aluminum, and it's basically a vicious cycle that continues to go on until the body can finally get on top of it. And in some vaccines, it's actually worse than others. We're finding that in the Gardasil vaccine, this is a big problem, and that these dendritic cells that get activated, sometimes they don't shut off, and this inflammation continues. So the dose of the aluminium, the state, the anti-inflammatory state that it's injected into, and where in the body it's injected is really important. Needle into muscle is what's key. So if anyone wants to argue with you about aluminium, ask them about the different routes of how it can come into the body. Well, it's presumed that aluminium is safe because it's been used in food and vaccines for 70 years, not because it's been tested against placebo and people followed out for long term, but just because it's been done for so long. Because of that, it continues to be added to the vaccine schedule with callous disregard for the many mechanisms of cell injury and the vast medical literature on its toxicity when it's injected, especially. In America, we are giving our babies their first dose of aluminium during pregnancy, and then we're giving them the second one on day one of birth when they get 250 microgram shot. And then just like you do here, we start off with the 1,200 microgram doses. That boy that I was presenting today, he got 8 different antigens on one day, 3 times in a row. That was a huge aluminium load that he got. And by the time babies are 18 months old, they're getting around 4,925 micrograms brought into their bodies. Well, there's one really important detail that's almost always left out of the discussion when it comes to aluminium, whether it's injection or ingestion, and that is, what is the kidney function of the person that has taken it in? Well, we know over history that when aluminium is in dialysis fluids, that those patients get really sick, their bones get sick, their brains don't function properly, and it's a big problem. You know, we worked really aggressively to get that aluminium out of the dialysis water before giving dialysis. It's that important if you don't have normal kidney function. Now, if you've got any degree of kidney dysfunction, chances are the aluminium is not going to be excreted as if you have 100% of kidney function. Well, who has low kidney function? It turns out that infants don't have the same percentage when you compare it using the same measurements as adults have, and that premature infants have really low kidney clearance. So, you know, to do these calculations and reassure parents that everything is fine because we've injected aluminium into one adult man intravenously and he got rid of it all, we can't reassure parents about injecting it into their newborns or their babies, because normal kidney function is about 90 mLs per minute per 1.73 meters squared. We have ways of measuring that, and that's just the standard consideration, that greater than 90 is considered normal. Well, when a premature baby is born, it's around 20. And then we can see over here that as time goes on, the average, what we call glomerular filtration rate, or the clearance of substances through the kidney that need filtration, and a 2 to 8 day old average is only around 40. And that it ranges from 17 to 60, so some of them have actually really low clearance, and they never checked to see what it is before injecting aluminium in these babies. And you can see that even up to 2 to 12 years, they say, it can only be on a low level, on the low range here, 89, but on average, up to 6 months, most kids don't have their kidney function up to speed. So we have to take this into consideration when doing these analyses, and you very rarely, I've never seen this taken into consideration with an aluminium analysis. There are very few of them out there that have actually injected real babies and looked to see what happened afterwards. But there is one that came out this year by Dr. Mobsis, and what she did was she injected 2-month-old human infants with three of the intramuscular, it was one injection, but three vaccines, and this is basically just according to the schedule, for a total of 1,200 micrograms of aluminium per the usual infant schedule. Well, this amounts to about 545 micrograms per kilogram of baby weight. The conclusion of this study, after they measured the urine and blood aluminium levels for 12 hours after they injected it, was that they said that they were reassured to find that there was no significant post-vaccine rise in serum aluminium level after vaccination of preterm infants containing 1,200 micrograms in other literature, and that in their study, they found that there also was no rise in the blood levels and urine levels after injection. So I thought to myself, well, why would you be relieved by that? You've injected aluminium, and you see that it doesn't rise in the blood, and it doesn't rise in the urine. Well, where did it go? And so I wrote to this doctor, and I asked her, and I said, are you aware that the kidney function of these babies is actually really low? And so I'm not surprised to not see a lot of aluminium in the urine. And you didn't find it in the blood, so where else could it have gone? It could only go to organs and to bone. And she wrote me back, and she said, quote, so we don't really know what happens to the aluminium at this point in time. As you said, more research is needed in this area. Okay? There's something called a minimal risk level that is a theoretical calculation that shouldn't be exceeded according to this theoretical calculation, because there could be neurotoxicity. And that's really the problem with aluminium, is that primarily the brain is very sensitive to it, and the nervous system is very sensitive to it. Well, this is a really interesting paper because they did these calculations. And if you go and you read the paper, you see that, first off, the calculations were based on rodents that were eating aluminium And the other way they looked at it was that one injection study by Priest that I mentioned already, which looked at one man who got a very small, it was 0.7 micrograms, okay, that's nowhere near what a baby gets, intravenously, and they tagged it with a radio-labeled, it was radio-labeled aluminium so that they could trace it in his system over time and see where it went. And what they found was that they said it was great because all the aluminium disappeared from the blood after 2 days, and only about 15% of it was taken up into the body and not immediately excreted, but that the aluminium in his body was down to 4% after 1,178 days. So that's about 3 years. And they also used a form of aluminium that's not as toxic as the aluminum hydroxide and aluminum phosphate that's used in vaccines. They use aluminum citrate. His kidneys were also normal. So these are the measurements that they're using for their theoretical calculation, an intravenous dose in one man, a very low dose with normal kidneys, and rats eating aluminium. And based on that, they say that we shouldn't exceed a certain dose of aluminium every day. And then they look at their theoretical ingestion, both in breast milk, and it is, there's low levels of aluminium in breast milk. There's low levels in formula. There's higher levels in vaccines. And so they looked at that and they saw, well, this is what we're calculating as the minimal risk line. And let's see if we add all this together, if it goes higher than that minimal risk line. And conveniently, we see that only spiked through a little bit right there. Well, one of the things with breast milk and formula is that the aluminum in substances that we eat has silicate on it. That's what's in the Earth's crust. It's totally different than this aluminum phosphate and this aluminum hydroxide that we're ingesting, okay? But the other problem with this analysis was that they only looked at hepatitis B and the DTP vaccine. They left out pneumococcal and Hib and hepatitis A, which was another 600 micrograms of aluminium. So even though they found that there were spikes for about 3 days at a time that went through this minimum risk level, they were reassuring that it's probably okay to have these vaccines, and it's not really a big problem in the formula breast milk, because look, it comes right back down and stays below that line. But what I'm telling you is that these babies don't have kidney function that's as high as that adult man or those rats that were tested, that we're injecting it in a form that they weren't using in those animal studies, and that they didn't look at the whole vaccine schedule. So this essentially is telling you that it can be toxic even with these small amounts of vaccines with this terrible analysis. Dr. Khan and other scientists in 2013 looked at the transport of aluminium into the brain. And after noting that after they did this full analysis, they noted that translocation does happen after intramuscular injections. They specifically looked at intramuscular injections. And then they issued a recommendation about that at the end of their paper. And they said, aluminium has high neurotoxic potential, and planning administration of continuously escalating doses of this poorly biodegradable adjuvant in the population should be carefully evaluated by regulatory agencies, since the compound may be insidiously unsafe. It is likely that good tolerance to aluminium may be challenged by a variety of factors, including over-immunization, blood-brain barrier immaturity, and individual susceptibility factors, and aging, that may be associated with subtle blood-brain barrier alterations and a progressive increase of these special transporters that I mentioned earlier called CCL2. They can be higher in some people, especially as we age, those transporters tend to go up. So the problem with aluminium is that the reason for its use and its efficacy and its toxicity are actually one and the same. The inflammation caused by intramuscular injection adds to the accumulation in lymph nodes, spleen, liver, brain, kidney. Kidney actually is highest, but then when they went and looked, they found that it's even higher deposition in the bone. So all those organs accumulate aluminium in all of us as we grow older. But if we're purposefully injecting it into a muscle and it doesn't have a way to get out very easily, this problem is even bigger. Well, in the 1980s, the amount of aluminium in your vaccine schedule was 1,120 micrograms for the whole schedule. And today, it's 6,150 micrograms. And the year that you did the MenZB vaccine, it was much higher than that, about 5,000 micrograms higher for those vaccines. Those started at 6 weeks of age. Kidney function was not up to 100% at that point. Well, there are more properties of aluminium, but I can't tell you all of them and all the 200 biological processes it inhibits, but there are a few more studies that are worth mentioning. There's one that showed that it damaged thymocyte and lymphocyte plasma membranes. So the thymus is really important in training the T cells what to react to and what not to react to. That was Dr. Kamilov, and he said it was at clinically relevant doses, meaning they were not giving mega doses to these animals. It also is known to enhance what's known as excitotoxicity in the brain, which I'll tell you more about that in a minute. These cells, microglia, are really important in the brain. You don't want them to be in a high inflammatory state, but aluminium activates them and inflames them. The literature is just abundant with articles and experiments that show that aluminium interferes with gene expression. It increases vascular endothelial adhesiveness, and Dr. Osterling stated point blank that aluminium is pro-inflammatory and it poses a cardiovascular disease risk. So for the rest of us that are adults and being recommended our aluminium-containing vaccines, we also need to think of this. The Cochrane Collaboration is a global independent network that tries to present evidence-based reviews. Dr. Thomas Jefferson came out with a surprising conclusion on the risk of adverse events after immunization with aluminium-containing DPT vaccines. He said that despite a lack of good quality evidence, we do not recommend that any further research on this topic is undertaken. Put the lid on it. Why? I thought, why on earth? And I kept reading, and the answer became obvious. Assessment of the safety of aluminium in vaccines is important because replacement of aluminium compounds in currently licensed vaccines would necessitate the introduction of a completely new compound that would have to be investigated before licensing. It would also have to be paid for through research and development for all the vaccine companies that would have to get new patents on their vaccines. No obvious candidates to replace aluminium are available. They've tried a few. It didn't go well. So withdrawal for safety reasons would severely affect the immunogenicity and protective effect of some currently licensed vaccines and threaten immunization programs worldwide. In other words, your individual safety is not of primary importance, and we don't need to be doing any research. Close the book. Well, pregnant women in America are recommended to get several aluminium-containing vaccines. All of these except influenza vaccine contains aluminium. And all of these vaccines cause massive inflammation. And during pregnancy, it's really important not to have massive inflammation.